Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by CRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks.
This week,
what the boys from Icon did next.
Selling Islam.
Explore the real values of Islam.
How the opinion cycle has replaced the news cycle.
The rise of IPTV.
The Apprentice and the Howzos.
Moleskine's turn in the social media blender. So with us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is Chris Stevenson, Strategy Director at Media Agency PhD and friend of the podcast. Also with us, Colin Delaney.
Hello.
Now, Chris, we turn to you first. Welcome back. What's new?
Hey, Tim. Good to be here. Gosh, politics, religion and PR storms all in one podcast.
All in one podcast.
Hold on to your seats.
All in one craftily packed 30 minutes that generally becomes 50.
Well, if I've got anything to do with it.
So what is new at the world of PhD?
PhD is good at the moment. We're back to full strength. We've got Lucy Formosa-Morgan is on board as training director. And we've got Marcus.
She came across from OMD, is
she
that
did,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, so we've...
So move within the family.
She's moved within the family. We've got her across the water to the CBD, to Kent Street. And she's now taking grasping hold of the trading product, which
okay.
is brilliant.
So who was running trading for you before that?
Well, Faith Campbell was on board previously.
And she went back to the US, is that right?
She did, yes. Yes. So she went back to the US for a while. So great to have Lucy on board and great to have her taking the reins of our trading product and making that happen.
Just in time for the annual negotiations.
Exactly.
And who else?
And Marcus Lewis is here as well, which is brilliant. He's our director of analytics and DR, so it's brilliant to have him on board.
Well, we will talk and analytics a little later
we
in
will.
The podcast. So what else has been going on? What's PhD been doing as an agency? What work?
Yeah, as always, a real focus on the work and thinking about the work leaving the building. So we've been doing some interesting stuff with them for HTC. They've got two phone models, Cha-Cha and Salsa, and we've been running a super user competition on Facebook for them. So really engaging those super users of Facebook to really activate and showcase the functionalities of the Cha-Cha and Salsa phones.
And this is sort of people, do they get the phone and review it, or are they already users, already consumers who've bought it in the past?
It's activity on the site to convey the ability that the Cha-Cha and Salsa have for social media.
Aren't they terrible names? The telephones, are they?
Yeah.
And they're called the Cha-Cha.
Yeah.
As in cha-cha-cha sort of thing.
As in cha-cha. Okay. They're awesome names. If I was going to name a phone, I probably would name it cha-cha and stuff.
They're for a very specific demographic, I suppose.
They possibly are. They're for a cool media, urban, gym-going demographic.
Really? Too. That speaks to me in many ways.
It does, actually, Tim.
Robin?
Yeah, Chris, without being too cynical, and correct me if I'm wrong, there hasn't been too much... Too many news items coming out of PhD on the new business front.
Harsh.
Right? And my question is this. When there's a whiff of a downturn, when things are getting a little bit tighter, does that play against agencies like PhD, which clients pay for the thinking, they pay for the strategy, and play into the hands of perhaps agencies, bigger agencies like Mitchell's, which can obviously play the price card?
I think it's a good question. I think that it's about short-term versus medium or long-term. I think in the short-term, there'll be a news agenda around cost efficiencies and around perhaps turns of economies. The reality is that for 21 years, PhD has been pioneering and finding a better way in terms of a strategic planning-led approach to clients. And that's what we'll continue to do, and that's what we'll be doing as cycles and news agendas and as the environment changes. The priority for us is to deliver great thinking and great planning to clients, backed up by an amazing trading product. You know, we've got an incredibly strong trading product. We've got incredibly strong buying backed up. But what that backs up is great thinking, and that is what we'll be talking about in years to come.
Is that tougher in a tough economy, though? Do you think that there are certain types of clients who do retreat back to straight buying when things are tough?
I think the conversation changes. I don't think the agenda does. So I think what clients want, they want smart solutions that grow their brands and business that can be proven and that can demonstrate cost effectiveness.
Now, the other thing that PhD, I think possibly the last time but one I saw you, was that AdShell did a creativity competition, mostly creative agencies, But there were two media agencies who entered as well, PhD, and I think the other one was Mediacom.
Yep.
You guys came second. So effectively, you were judged that night to be more creative than most of the creative agencies.
It was a good night.
Yes, a fluke, or does it say something about what media agencies can do now in thinking creatively? Does it say anything at all, or was it just a, you know,
I think it says lots.
Competition?
I think it says lots.
Yeah, well, I gave you a nice soft question and you hit it out of the park.
Because I'm going to run with this one, Tim. I think it does say a lot. I think it says that the ability to generate creative solutions in and around connection points is everyone's remit, and that's what it speaks to. It's not about whether it's creative agencies or media agencies or PR agencies or DM agencies coming up with great ideas. Great ideas can come from anywhere. So speaks to anything, it's about the fact that the great use of any connection can come from anywhere.
Do you remember what the brief was and what your solution was?
Yeah, it was for a charity brief. Was it
Headspace?
I think it was Headspace, and it was about...
Which is youth.
It's depression, specifically amongst young men, and getting young men to acknowledge and take action on depression. And the solution was in and around an ad shell. And so the solution that we had was to kit out an ad shell unit with a couch in there, so people could, you know, give in that idea that it's okay to lie down, talk to someone and seek help and just cut through and get under people's radar. And the judges really liked it. And interestingly, the idea that pipped us, which was BMF, I think.
Yeah, I think it was BMF.
Yeah, I think it was BMF. They had a great idea where the actual glass screen cracked and continued to crack. So two great solutions to the issue, which is about just cut through and really using media to tell the story and to convey the message that you want to convey. And it was brilliant to see PhD up there, and a great shout out to the kids that were there and made it happen, and good on them.
Next, can you marry media and DM?
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Bohemia is a new media agency that, quote-unquote, marries the art of communication strategy with the science of direct response. It was founded by Simon White of media agency Icon and ex-Icon colleagues Brett Dawson and Chris Christofi, as well as ex-Combat online manager Peter Lever. So, Chris, this isn't necessarily a new idea. I've heard of the concept before, but what do you think about building an agency around the idea of media plus data analytics?
I think it's a great move. I think that it's great for them, and it's great to see them doing it, and it's great to see this happening in the market. The extent to which it's new, I don't think is what's important. I think the reality is that all great media agencies are built on data. The power of the media agency has always been in data, and it will always be in data, and the idea to bring data rigour to what we do and how we do it. That said, it's great to see these guys very good at what they do, setting up and setting their stall out in what seems to be a very channel-neutral and data-centric and very consumer-centric, actually, a very people-centric way. And that for me, is what rings out in this press release. It's a very people-centric way of thinking about how we plan and how you plan media using data. So it's absolutely right, and it's great to see it happening.
So it's perhaps not something new. As you mentioned, all media agencies do it. I remember Starcom a few years back launched they repositioned around the idea of intent, and they had this really expensive, impressive planning tool. But when I dug a little deeper, I discovered that clients would have to pay extra for that. It's actually a really expensive thing to use in terms of deep diving consumer data. I just wondered, a PhD, do clients have to pay extra for sophisticated planning tools?
No, in these financially interesting times, we at PhD do not charge our clients for core planning capabilities. There are, of course, extra things like big econometric projects that we get involved with. Of course, they've got to be funded. We don't. Our core planning product is Aetna, and that's fueled by the channel planning really product, which is neuroplanning, which sits at the heart of that, and that's something that all our clients use and get as part of being with PhD.
And your planning product, how often do you create a new planning platform? Is it the sort of thing that every year or every 2 years you have to reinvent it and start again, or is it the sort of thing you just kind of iterate?
Certainly not that year, and certainly not every year. We do iterate all the time. So all the time we're continuing to think about how we take that planning product and use it and adapt it, and it does evolve. It evolved from the very start. I remember when we first got presented newer planning, and literally a bunch of 50 planners in London had broken it within minutes, but then fixed it again. It was almost in like beta and iteration from the very off. That said, big reiterations come along, and we might see that coming soon. Who knows?
And this is a tool developed locally or part of a global system?
It's global now, very much so. So now that we're firmly established as a global network, we'd want to see those planning capabilities and consistency, I think, happen at a global level. I think these days it's really important and powerful for any client, let alone a bigger one, to consistently be able to see how something's being thought about and deployed in Singapore as much as it is in Sydney, as much as it is in Jakarta.
And if you had to make predictions about how that sort of tool would look in 6 months, a year, 2 years' time, how would it differ from now, do you think?
I think as any planning tool evolves for PhD, I think I'd like to see it become perhaps more socialised, perhaps more real-time, perhaps more day-to-day.
What do you mean by socialised?
Socialised in terms of planners being really embedded and present in the system. So in the way that the most engaging things that we get involved with, be it social media, be it other platforms, I see no reason why a media planning platform couldn't be like that. How does Chris plug into the planning product and get out of that planning product solutions for brands and clients and media connections?
And linking the planning to the data as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that being data fueled will be essential. But it's almost how you can make that as automated as possible. How can you focus on generating insights from data rather than focusing on manipulating the data? I think that the best planning systems, and that's what's interesting about this, about the press release and the move that we've seen from the former Icon guys, is really about what you do with that data. And the interesting conversation in the media industry about whether data is the cost of entry or whether it's the new black, really is an aside. The point
is... Funny you should mention that.
Yeah, no, there's been indeed a bit of discussion about whether or not data is the new black. James Greet, the boss of Mindshare, said to The Australian this week,
I think the only way in which you can survive in a fragmenting world is to recognise that data is the new black, data is king, and that you really need to build it into your operating model. Now, we're not saying it just begins and ends with data. What we're saying is data is a means to an end to improve the creativity which we deploy on behalf of our clients' brands. Okay, so it's about analytics and data and creativity. I think before people used to see analytics and creativity in two separate camps. Now they're one and the same.
And here's what David Gaines from Maxis said to AdNews.
Yeah, well, as David knows, data is the new black. Right?
Sorry, I think I was just sickling in my mouth. Yeah.
No, okay, it's not. It's creative.
No,
it's a creative.
It's cost of entry.
Oh, cost of entry.
It is. It's not the new black. It's cost of entry. It's a bit like saying we buy cheap media.
So data in the black thing is passe. It's 80s.
Data in the new black is about 3 or 4 years old. If you don't know how to analyse, work out cause and effect, use data effectively as an agency, should be media.
Good one.
So data the new black. Is it old hat? Is it just cost of entry, or is it something clients still want to hear?
I'm not. Quite sure often I'll say this, but I think Gaines and Greet are right on this one. I think,
even though they're completely contradicting each
other. Well, I think it's true to say the data is a cost of entry. You know, you cannot be in this market unless you can use, manipulate, and get insights from data. At the same time, continually inventing it and continually finding new ways, interesting ways to harness data is absolutely right as well.
And do you agree with David Gaines when he said that when people say data is the new black, it makes you a little bit sick in your mouth?
I've never been sick in my mouth.
Just to build on that, so if you're a creative, old school creative like John Hegarty.
If I was a creative, I wouldn't be sick in my mouth either.
Yeah, and I've heard John Hegarty from obviously an old school advertising legend saying that he's never used his research, never relies on data. What happened to good old fashioned instinct? What happened to people in advertising, marketers having a hunch, being able to just instinctively tap into what a consumer is feeling? What do you say to people like that of the old school?
It's got to be both. It's It's mental to think that we can do media and advertising in the 21st century intuitively, and just put our finger in the air and kind of think, do you know what? I've got an idea. At the same time, logic without magic is nothing, you know, and having reams of data without the insight and the ability to creatively interpret that and come up with imaginative ways to use that is nothing either. It's to take either extreme, as we might talk about soon, to use an extreme of any debate or any argument, it gets you nowhere.
Next, advertising Islam.
This week saw the launch of a new campaign by Islamic group My Peace to acquaint and educate non-Muslim Australians with the religion of Islam. The ad quotes from the Quran alongside everyday Australians in related circumstances. Let's take a bit of a listen.
To save one life is as though you have saved all of humanity. Show kindness to your parents, just as they cherished you in childhood. Give in charity of the good things you earn. Even a smile is charity. Explore the real values of Islam at mypeace.com.au.
Now, Robin, before we talk about the campaign, one of the things we did notice, and you were doing a lot of the moderating on this as well, is lots of the comments that came in on the Mumbrella comment stream, we actually had to veto quite a lot of them. What was their issue?
Yeah, there were a lot of quite disturbingly anti-Islamic comments. But yeah, without pushing religion aside, I think that one comment that was made was that Islam as a brand needs to revamp in Australia. The brand name, My Peace, the name of the advertiser, they thought was sort of oxymoronic, and it represented a religion they thought had nothing to do with peace. That was, yeah, again, comments that were not published. But yeah, so fair enough. I saw the ad. It was sort of okay. But yeah, as an advertiser, I don't think My Peace, which you should remember, has created one of the most complained about ads of the year, a poster which read Jesus: a prophet of Islam. So I think the advertiser, which is fair enough, it should be allowed on Australian airtime, like pretty much any advertiser, but it was caught in controversy with its poster.
Chris, what would be your advice to a religion that's wanting to advertise?
I think it's a fascinating bit of work from a planning and from a purely strategic perspective. I think the first thing is that it's a good ad. Okay. The second thing is that I do think it opens a broader debate about what should and shouldn't be allowed in advertising. I think, Robin, you made the point that everyone should be allowed to advertise. I'm not sure if everyone should be allowed to advertise. I think that part of society's debate and part of the conversation in society should be what should and shouldn't be allowed to be given voice in what are mass deployment and mass broadcast elements within society. If something starts a constructive conversation, that can only be a good thing. As the question of what advice I would give to a religion that's choosing to advertise, it's actually the same advice I'd give to any advertiser, which is don't advertise for the sake of it, but understand what the role for comms is. And that's what's really fascinating about this. When I saw this ad, I found myself thinking, well, look, what's the role for communication here? Is this a direct response campaign? Is it a recruitment campaign? Or is this perception change? And they're very different things. And it strikes me that, Robin, you made a good point that if this is caught in controversy for controversy's sake, the danger is that in the long term, this will do more damage than good to the brand. So for me, as a planner and as a strategist, what's really interesting is what are they trying to do with this? What's the role for comms? And generally, planners can kind of spot this. Generally, a few years of doing what you do, certainly you begin to see, you know, what people are trying to do with communications, and certainly when you see different media added together. The fascinating question for me on this is just what are they trying to achieve?
Do you know, and I'd be interested to know what you thought of it, Robin.
In the press release, I must just say that it was clearly stated that the idea behind the ad was to educate Australia about Islam, which I don't think the TV ad actually achieved.
It's not doing that.
It's hard to do that in 30 seconds, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but the reality is that if you... You know, we talked about newer planning earlier on, the planning process. One of the principles of newer planning is that brands don't exist on posters or on TV. Brands exist in people's heads. Yeah. And they exist as a set of associations. And right now, if the job is to educate Australians about Islam, then they're not addressing the current engram.
But I think, if I may weigh in, I felt like, you know, when they read the pieces from the Quran, if you're, as I was, brought up in a, you know, Christian household, those quotes are very similar to what you would find in the Bible. And I think what they're trying to say is Islam is very similar to Christianity, you know, and trying to very much steer away from all the, obviously, all the terrorist links and so forth. So I think from an education point of view, I think it did work.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's almost one
as
of
opposed
the issues
to the poster,
we,
sorry, yeah. which did feel very provocative.
Talk me through the poster.
The
old poster.
The old poster that
Jesus,
says Jesus.
The prophet of Islam, yeah. Yes. Although, certainly, the comments that came into our back end, and some of them just kind of came outside of moderation policy, often did link Islam with terrorism, with the word terrorism. But to me, that was exactly what the purpose of the campaign is to kind of, you know, de-link those sort of perceptions and kind of, you know, I guess correct the perceptions as well.
But it didn't explicitly say Islam, which as a word means peace, doesn't it? It didn't explicitly try to disconnect Islam with terrorism, did it? It doesn't actually deal with the crux of the problem, which is many Australians do link Islam with terrorism.
That would be a fascinating creative brief if you were to write it. Yeah. Disassociate Islam and terrorism.
I suppose the question is,
you can put that under Groon transfer. That's Groon could tackle that.
Yeah, it would be a good one for Groon, actually. I mean, I suppose the thing is, though, you know, even if that's the, for want of another phrase, the elephant in the room, would you actually, with the first stage of the campaign, would that be the single point that you would tackle first of all? Or actually, would you kind of come at that one slightly more gently?
I think my advice probably would be to come for it gently. I mean, the reality is all religions are the same. All religions fundamentally reflect the desire to do good and be good. You know, as a society functions because we're good to each other. And religion gives us an explanation for that. You know, religion fills a God-shaped hole in all of our psyches, which is why the memes have thrived and survived.
How did you feel about the... It's a little while back now, but the Ad Standards Board, the Atheist Foundation of Australia tried to put up a billboard basically arguing there was no God. There was controversy in the UK, but eventually it was allowed to be posted. I think it was something like, you know, there probably is no God, stop worrying about it, or something along those lines.
I think the Australian one was sleep in on Sundays.
Yeah, which, Chris, deserve to be banned, do you think?
No, I think anything that starts a constructive conversation and that anything that promotes what a group of people believe or think is right should be allowed. You know, we shouldn't be in the business of censoring. I think that what we should be very watchful of and cautious of is inconsistency. And I think that as any society should say, if a particular group is allowed to advertise and put forward a point of view, then all groups that fall into that category should be allowed to have that point of view. And I think that the problem has already arisen if one rule applies to religion and another rule applies to an atheist group that are looking to convey a similar message.
Next, is opinion more important than news?
Lachlan Harris, Kevin Rudd's former press secretary, spoke to the Public Relations Institute of Australia's annual conference saying that the opinion cycle had replaced the news cycle. Harris said, "The most underestimated change in the last 5 years is that the opinion cycle is now important than the news cycle. The tweets, comments, blogs, emails and talkback calls that a news story generates are now so pervasive they become more important and more influential than the actual story as first written." Here's some audio from the session.
Opinion happened. By that, I mean that one of the most significant structural changes in the media landscape in the last 5 years has been the rise and rise and rise of the opinion cycle. A lot has changed in media and politics in recent years, but the most underestimated change in the last 5 years is that the opinion cycle is now more important than the news cycle. Opinion pieces, opinion makers, opinionated hosts, opinionated callers, opinionated commenters, opinionated commentators, guilty, opinionated analysis, opinionated panel members, opinionated panel adjudicators, opinion, opinion, opinion. No one wrote a news story about it, but in Australia in the last 5 years, news has been eclipsed by opinion. Opinion has always been a big part of the media, but until recently it was nowhere near as big as the news. The news cycle still lives on in Australia. It's still incredibly important, and as we all know in this room, you neglect the news cycle at your peril. But in the Australian media market, the apprentice has become the master, because opinion now reigns supreme.
Harris went on to say that Andrew Bolt sits in a position of influence, where 7:30 reports Kerry O'Brien once did. So, Tim, you're at the conference. What's your opinion on Lachlan's opinion on opinion?
Yeah, it was one of those. It was one of those presentations where normally, if someone's giving a presentation, you kind of you hear a quote, you put a little star by it next to your shorthand because that's the quote you're going to use. And within about 2 minutes, it was just star, star, star. And eventually I just had to stop putting stars by everything because, as you would hope from a press secretary, he was a one-man quote machine. It was a really good presentation. It was very well thought through. There's a reasonably long version of it on the site that you can see. And also, if you Google Opinion Cycle and Lachlan Harris, you'll see a column that he wrote for the Sunday Telegraph some weeks back making a similar point. But absolutely the point he was making is that whereas the news cycle is a 24-hour cycle, you know, you do something in the morning, it'll get picked up by, say, Talk Back, it'll make the evening TV news and make the papers the next day, or something like that. For the opinion cycle, it goes on much longer because it's about finding the fault line of an argument and then just mining it, which is why we're seeing things like immigration just stay around as a topic that just goes on for day after day after day. And the argument he's making is that certainly for politicians and people looking at sort of attempting to manage or influence media around politics, this has all changed in the last 5 years. This is a new phenomenon, and nobody knows quite what to do with it and quite how to handle it. You know, nobody is there yet. But additionally, he makes the point that it's spreading beyond politics as well. So it's something that anyone in PR advising brands is going to need to know, particularly with the rise of social media commentary as well. You know, he's making the point that there are big brands that are absolutely terrified, that are, you know, hiding under the table because they're terrified of just being slaughtered for no, you know, not even, you know, controversial brands, just your typical Australian brand. But he's also making the point, because it's this bad publicity backlash is becoming increasingly common, you know, the memory of it disappears quicker as well. So it may just become a fact of life. We talked about data being the new black. He described bad publicity as being the new black.
So, Chris, what do you think of that? Do you think that news has become perhaps a more disposable commodity that's quickly replaced? Do you think it's been, replaced by opinion?
Yeah, I think opinion is now a lot more important, but I've got nothing to back that up with. What do I think?
Well, funnily enough, that was one of the points he was making, is you can't be called out for being wrong about an opinion. He was actually making that point. You can say you hate Julia Gillard and no one can prove you wrong, whereas if you get a fact wrong, you can be proved wrong.
I think what he said is absolutely true. We are now in an opinion-led media arena. And whether or not you like that or agree with that, the fact is that's what it is. It's happened for three reasons, I think. It's happened, one, because of financial restraints and the fact that it's a lot cheaper to produce opinion than it is to produce facts and rigorously pursue journalism. I think it's happened because we live in complicated times. And I think that people are outsourcing the thinking for them, and they want people to tell them what they should think, what they think they should do. But I also think that's because we are all media owners now. In 2016, which is PhD's most recent book, available at Amazon, we talk about the fact that there are now 1.2 billion media owners on the planet. There are 1.2 billion of us online and growing rapidly all the time. And so everyone is a media owner now.
Not everyone has an audience and a following, though, do they? And presumably, to anyone in PR.
Yeah, they do. Just the size of the audience is different.
Yes, that's what you have to decide, though, isn't it? You know, which ones matter?
Yeah, but I mean, that's why Andy Warhol was almost right. You know, we're not famous for 15 minutes. We're all famous to 15 people. So all of us are all the time famous to 15 people. It's just that some people become famous to 1,500 or 15,000 or 15 million people.
Yeah, to your point, Tim, it's just worth linking into what Mumbrella reader Geeks commented He or she said, I have a fist-shaking session at the TV every Monday night during Media Watch and Q&A. But the sad fact is Current Affair, Today Tonight, News Corp Papers, Andrew Bolt, creepy Graham Richardson, Alan Jones, they dish out tripe every day, yet they rate. Yet someone like George Negus gets boned. Why? In my opinion, people are mostly lazy and like their thinking done for them.
Yeah, which is which argues it really, really well. You know, we've just seen in recent weeks the end of the 6:30 with George Negus on 10, which absolutely was about a slightly more intelligent approach than what was going on the other channels, which is more about sort of consumer current affairs, I suppose.
I think that happens as well, partly because as a media industry and as a broader communications industry, we value reach and size of audience more than we value engagement, or more than we value what people are getting out of the content. And I think that as long as reach and size is more important as a currency for the media industry, then this is going to happen.
The other thing, of course, is cause and effect. So, you know, I guess Lachlan Harris was arguing that absolutely this is affecting how politicians behave, because it becomes doing certain things. Trying to affect any sort of significant political change is harder than ever before, because it's easier to argue for the status quo. And Laurie Oakes gave the Andrew Olley media lecture on Friday night, which I was also at. And one of the points he was making, one of many points, and again it was a kind of, you know, quite a wide-ranging thing, but was that actually politicians kind of need to grow a bit more of a backbone as well, and go from what's almost happened is, as they've run out of agenda, they've looked at, okay, well, what will play well with the press? That's what our policy will be, rather than the old way of deciding what the right policy was and then looking at how to spin it, you know, and that's a sort of fundamental change.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are fascinating parallels between the situation that politicians are in and the situation that advertisers are in. It's been harder, it's become harder and harder to stay control of the message. But rather than finding new ways to engage people with your message, both have chosen to look for to look for people to tell them what the message should be. That's what's gone wrong here. People, we shouldn't be looking for whether you're an advertiser, whether you're a politician. You shouldn't be looking to people to tell you what they think you should be thinking. Use new media and use these new forms that we have to engage people with your opinion and to sell it.
Yeah, partly because we're relaunching Encore magazine at the moment. I've been thinking a lot about just this notion of storytelling. And I guess that works for politicians or for brands or for anybody else. This idea of you've got to choose what your story is and tell it and find strategies for telling it, which maybe is something which certainly for sort of politics lost in the daily spin. The politicians who don't have a story are the ones who are struggling.
Next, the rise in IPTV.
Thinking of working at an ad agency? Looking for the best creatives to develop your next ad campaign? Look no further than the Mumbrella Creative Agency Review. 148 pages of hardcore industry intelligence to help you make your next big agency decision. Visit book.focalattractions.com.au/MCAR.
This week saw Optus launch the digital television service MeTV with help from Fetch TV. The service will cost $9.95 per month over 2 years, available to Optus fixed and mobile customers. It will include 30 pre-selected on-demand movies per month and 7 additional films every week. Also announced this week, QuickFlix launched their new streaming movie service, which has a hat tip to Netflix from the US's business model, but it's the first of its kind in Australia, priced at $15 per month initially with Sony devices. Now, Chris, you've mentioned that you've published Beyond 2016, available at Amazon, all about...
all proceeds to charities, yeah.
Well, that's very, very good of you. And 2016 is about changing media habits around technology. Stuff like this streaming video, does this tie in with your thinking? Is this where it's going?
Absolutely. One of the main threads within 2016 and within the conversations that we're having with clients and beyond about how media is changing is this notion of increased control and this notion of more fragmentation in platforms, which means that people will essentially increasingly demand what they want to watch, when they want to watch it. And that does change the rules.
What does it mean for traditional TV owners?
Well, it means that broadcast interruption as the de facto model has got to be reconsidered. So it means that just creating one message, which can then be deployed to as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, has got to be reconsidered and reevaluated. And it's got to be replaced with how can we make things relevant to people in real time? How can we deploy different communications and tweaked communications to different different groups, different people based on what they're interested in? But it also means you've got to create things that sit behind just the interruption message. You've got to create these platforms for these brand ideas, the platforms for things brands stand for, and use those to communicate and resonate with people across a whole gamut of touch points, because people are in control.
Now, Colin, back to the Quickflix streaming model. You've been talking to Chris Taylor, who's the boss of Quickflix, formerly of Telstra. What's your take on this? What's the significance of it?
Well, they've just started this streaming system.
Week.
Yeah, this week. Before that, they were a DVD mail-out service. To me, I think they'll also have TV shows as well in the not-too-distant future. To me, I felt that Quickflix, I mean, if I was a consumer, I would probably opt for Quickflix over these other two, if we include also Big Pond. Big Pond have tried to work very much with sport TV channels. That's their primary focus.
Although, it feels funny enough, the attraction to me of the MeTV one, the Optus one, is the fact that you can also use it to, you know, pause and record live TV, you know, as in free-to-air TV, which seems to me a pretty, you know, until I painfully moved and could no longer have my Foxtel IQ, seems not a bad alternative to Foxtel IQ.
Yeah, right. I mean, to me, what MeTV lacked, I mean, it felt like they've got apps, they've got their Facebook app and their YouTube app, and it felt like just a really big computer, whereas, you know, some of us already have a really big computer in the other room. So as far as sort of the competition goes, it feels like Quickflix is, they've refined their, they're not trying to be many different things, they're film, and you don't need kind of, they're not selling all the hardware on top, whereas Optus are primarily there, you know, they've got their content, but they're also, you know, do this with our broadband, with our set-top box. Similarly, Big Pond.
Chris?
I think all this points to a direction of travel, which is proliferation of channels, and this is going to have a big effect. And I think that you just got to look to the Australia versus New Zealand match. Sorry to bring that up. On October 16th.
The rugby,
yeah. 1.79 million watching on Nine, 700,000 on Foxtel. So it's not that these things are tinkering around the edge. This proliferation of platforms is now having very real consequences. And Barry O'Brien, actually, he's the chief executive of PhD, was writing in the Australian Financial Review, and he was saying that the way he sees this is the Australian public doesn't differentiate anymore between free-to-air TV, pay TV, or whatever. They go where the pictures are, and that's what's happening here. People will get what they want to watch when they want to watch it on their terms. And we're going to be racing to catch up unless we stay ahead of the game and try to understand what a world might look like in 2016.
Next, The Week in TV.
This Week on TV saw two new shows premiere, Celebrity Apprentice and Halzo's. So Celebrity Apprentice, which is stripped across weeknights, rated 1.3 million on its first outing, while Halzo's on SBS took a not too bad 245,000. Let's have a listen to the dulcet tones of Halzo's.
We hang down on the block. This is where we live, and we just don't give a fuck. 'Cause we don't have a job. Some scam, and others rob. We wear thongs, bro. We do AVOs. We wear Uggs, bro.
Where'd me kids go?
And if you're coming up to seven, you might end up in heaven.
Why? 'Cause we're Halzo's. Halzo's, 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 Halzo's.
Getting to be good friends. Yeah, fucking come down to Sunnyvale, mate.
So, Colin, you chatted to the director of Halzo's, Paul Fenwick. How did the conversation go?
Yeah, good. You know, anyone that's familiar with Paul or Paulie, as he's...
As you call him.
As I call him.
Poor mate.
And as sort of all of Australia that are familiar with his brand of comedy goes, knows him as. He was very easygoing, and he was a bit dirty that SBS had placed Howzo's at 10 o'clock. His previous shows, Pizza and Swift and Shift Couriers, had been at around the 8:30 slot, but Howzo's was pushing the envelope, although he was very proud of Howzo's, and he said that what he sees in Howzo's he hasn't seen in his comedy since the early episodes of Pizza. Although a lot of other people, both on Encore and on Mumbrella, have sort of chimed in with their opinion about Howzo's maybe being not that funny. Other people have come in support of him.
I'll tell you what, I was looking on Twitter as the conversation was going on, as the show was going out, and I would say 80 to 90% of the people talking about it were fans, were enjoying it. You know, which is a higher proportion than you usually see. Now, probably what it says is a smaller audience, but a more engaged audience. Still a pretty good audience for SBS. But yeah, you know, it's one of those. You know, arguably the jobs of any of the, you know, the publicly funded broadcasters is to do stuff that wouldn't get made on mainstream, and it probably wouldn't. You know, probably not. You know, not the sort of comedy I would choose. I guess because friend of the podcast, Jason Davis, Jabba was in it. It was hard to be completely neutral about it because he just wanted it, you know, to go well.
To go well, yeah.
And, you know, and certainly in ratings and audience response, it did. So, yeah, I have a lot of sympathy with this sort of his argument that, you know, there's this sort of, you know, latte sipping kind of snobbery about, you know, comedy for bogans.
No, indeed. And he sort of said that, you know, 60% of Australia, whether the media commentators like it or not, love V8 cars. And they, you know, if you were to advertise around Howzo's, you wouldn't have a Chanel ad, but you might have Britney Spears' latest perfume. You would have army recruitment. You would have, cars and fast food. So, I mean, outside of the metropolitan area, there are, you know, all of Australia that do love this slapstick style of humour, which is what... And he also made mention that, you know, Howzo's really harks back to the era of Paul Hogan's kind of Aussie, you know, Aussie humour. He was surprised also that he was getting a bad rap for insulting bogans, which, you know, this is the most Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-specific comedy he's done. Paul is, I'm not sure of his background, but, you know, his humour has always been about the WOG and about, you know, that kind of the immigrant humour, if you will.
To pick up to the point of your conversation with Paul, where he said he was disappointed with the 10 p.m. slot that SBS had given him. And I met with SBS earlier this week and spoke with the marketing director, and she said that, yeah, Paul was having a bit of a whinge. And there'll be no opportunity for that 10 p.m. Time slot to shift. She said that SBS is not like commercial broadcasters and was less fickle than that, and that the 10 p.m. Time slot would stick. So, so Chris...
you're also a latte sipper, Chris.
Yeah.
I sip lattes all the time.
Yeah, another point that...
I live in Surrey Hills as well, unfortunately.
Sorry. Yeah, another point that Paul made during his conversation with Colin was that you mightn't advertise Chanel around the show, but maybe Britney Spears' new perfume. So what do you suggest to clients in terms of advertising around Howzo's?
I think that I'd give the advice I'd give to any client, which is if you've got content, you're looking to maximise the relevance of that in and around programming and in and around shows. And if Howzo's is right and relevant, then we'll absolutely maximise the opportunity to be there. I think there's a bigger issue here and a bigger problem here, which is about labelling, putting people in boxes, badging people, and this notion around bogan and this sense that there's, you know, you can label someone a bogan. I think that it's the fault of everyone. Everyone is complicit in labelling people who are individual with individual thoughts and aspirations and thinking into these boxes and labels.
I think there is an assumption, though, on the other side, that media agency people... In Sydney, they don't go beyond Surrey Hills. In Melbourne, they don't go beyond St Kilda. That
I go to Darlinghurst all the time.
Which is a joke that only anyone in Surrey Hills and Darlinghurst would get, probably. But the point being that agency people actually don't understand a lot of real Australia. Is that a fair criticism, do you think?
I'm not sure it is. I don't think it's fair at all. I think that media agencies spend a lot of time and energy in really neutrally approaching audiences and finding ways to define and classify and think about audiences in new terms. You know, certainly at PhD, we work really hard not to think about an audience as a demographic or not to think about an audience as an age group or as a bogan or anything like that. We should be finding much more sophisticated ways, and our clients deserve more sophisticated, better ways to capture and define audiences than cheap labels like that.
Well, the other TV programme that we have been talking about is Celebrity Apprentice.
About cheap label.
Three ex-footy jocks, a redneck politician, a bikini model in a sash, a contestant from another reality show. Let's have a little listen.
I won the block. I can win this. I'm not what you expect.
My strategy is as tight as my shorts.
Please explain.
It's not business, it's show business. You've never seen anything like it.
Drop down and give me 20.
12 celebrities all fired up for charity.
Show me the money.
Nine's new Celebrity Apprentice.
Wow. Winning is part of my DNA.
You're fired. Coming soon.
So, Tim, what do you reckon? Do you think Celebrity Apprentice is any better?
I'm loving Celebrity Apprentice. Why? I'm not sure it is any better, but I'm loving it. I've always loved the format. It worked really well in the UK, worked really well in the US. First series in Australia of The Apprentice didn't work so well. Celebrity Apprentice, early days, were in the first week, just a couple of challenges, a couple of firings. Really intriguing characters, really dislikable characters, which is what you need. You know, kind of, it was almost a shame that Warwick Kappa was kicked out so early because, you know, he had the annoyance factor that he could have gone on annoying for some time. Max Markson, I think everyone always called, he was going to be one of the stars of it in a kind of dislikable, larger than life sort of way. So he's proved to be exactly that. You know, he's the sort of person, you know, I spent some time with him, massively entertaining company, but you shouldn't believe a word he ever says. But that's part of the game with him. And absolutely, it's a game, you know, they're all great characters, dislikable characters. I think it's going to be a hit.
Recent episode, they were charged with two KFCs head-to-head. The bosses of two KFCs went head-to-head. How did that work for you?
Yeah, so that was the contest went out on Wednesday night between, you know, and it's still divided between boys and girls at the moment, running the two KFCs. And the bit I most enjoyed was where you saw Marsha Hines getting all kind of offended by Polly from the block being labelled a celebrity when, you know, she'd been on a reality show.
Polly and I had a moment in the car, and there was just a few times where I felt like she was saying certain things that she shouldn't say.
Still get my text this morning.
Oh, they're doing, like, this. This is what Max does. This is why Max burns a lot of people, but you keep thinking he's a good person.
I think he is.
Yeah.
I have not been.
Yeah, but you've been in the industry for, like, 2 seconds.
Okay, please stop saying that to me.
Why?
Because I find it very disrespectful.
Oh, well.
No, I honestly do. Okay. I'm asking you as a team member to please stop referring to yourself as being in this industry forever and me not being in it, because I've earned my way here.
Celebrity is an easy word these days, and basically anyone can be famous if they're on the television for long enough. I know you weren't talking to me, but okay.
No,
I didn't hear it. It went in one, it went out the other.
That's very mature of you, Debbie.
Thank you very much, Mum.
Are you serious? Is this really how you talk to people? I find it very offensive.
Okay.
I've well earned my right to be here. And I have proved myself to these girls. I have worked my absolute batootie off, and I'd just like a little bit of respect for it.
That was kind of addressing one of the issues, the fact that Nine labelled one of the winners of, you know, one of their reality contests a celebrity. So it's quite nice they actually addressed it. And it was quite nice seeing the tension over that. So they got some out of it. Massive product integration, obviously, with things like, you know, a whole episode of KFC. Clearly they were a sponsor for it. But not as clunky as it has been in some other things. Like something like The Block, like, you know, the whole, and now we're going to, you know, send you off in your rough riding, whatever the vehicle was, felt really clunky. This, because it's so integrated into the show, kind of works.
But I think also because it's so real, I think that the fact that the integration works is because this is a real situation, a real context where they're trying to solve a genuine problem in a real life of KFC. And I think there's a big lesson there in product integration that if you can do it in just a genuine, real way, it does genuinely just work a lot better.
And I guess that's why MasterChef worked so well for the likes of Coles.
Absolutely.
And Handy Ultra. That's Handy the Ultra. Ones I took out of it.
And good on Nine, for getting it. It seems like they've really got this right. And hopes and expects it'll do well for them.
Next, Moleskin cops are hiding.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Moleskin received flak from designers when the posh notebook company ran a competition to come up with a new logo for their blog, Moleskinnery. I hope it's pronounced that way. Robin, this is a story that you wrote. Perhaps explain a little bit more about this one.
Yeah, well, the response to the competition was pretty vociferous, I must say. I mean, members of the design community dubbed that competition Mole Scheme, and accused the company of exploitation and devaluing design, crowdsourcing creativity, that sort of thing. And Moleskin's Facebook page was inundated with comments from so-called fans, and it prompted Moleskin to issue a response that basically said, if you don't like it, don't enter. It was a massive time delay before they issued the expected apology and stated that they'd offer a €5,000 prize and only retain the rights of the winner, not all the entrants.
And it's funny that you say a massive time delay, because that says something about social media, because we talk about like 24 or 48 hours. Now is a massive time delay. Chris, where do you sit on all this?
I think it's for me, it's a real distinction and difference between strategy and execution. I think the strategy is absolutely right. It's absolutely right for a brand to engage what's a passionate community in their brand and how they're developing it. But sweet Lord, it's a failure of execution, isn't it? I think that first press release basically reads like how not to respond to something like this. And even in the second one, where they got a lot more right when that letter that they wrote to address it, there's a phrase in the second paragraph where it says, since taking over Moleskinnery, and that single phrase betrays that 20th century thinking that's still there, and the fact that they've taken over a site and they think they've taken over a site that was developed for community by community. The rules have changed. The engagement's got to change. It's absolutely the right strategy to engage the community on this, but it seems like a failure of execution.
I'll tell you the one thing that makes me feel that maybe they deserve an element of understanding is, you know, this isn't redesign the Moleskin brand. This is, you know, the image for the blog, which makes me think that actually they were doing it for the. You know, really, it wasn't to get a cheap logo.
Not at all.
It was for the purpose of interacting with the community.
It's a great strategy. It's the right solution. It's absolutely the right thing to be doing. But they got lost in execution.
In fact, last night I met with the MD of Interbrand, Richard Curtis, and he said he's very, very much 50-50 split on this. Obviously, he's got a big team of designers. He thinks it perhaps could reflect the sensitivity of the design community. Obviously, they feel a little bit jilted. They don't want to give their genius creativity away for free.
But they live in Surrey Hills too.
Yeah, no, indeed. And it was the tone of the initial response by Moleskin that was defensive.
That's what
sparked the sort of anger. And then the apology came too late, and that was it. Social media storm.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Chris.
Pleasure to be here. I'll give my regards to Fiona.
To Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
And to Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip. That is all we have time for today. Thank you to Fiona.
Why do you call me Fiona?
Because it
Thanks,
says
Fiona.
That in the script.
I'm Fiona, third Thursday of the month, and that is it. Okay? Fiona never comes out, certainly in the professional arena.
I was going to warn you about that. I saw it this morning and I was like...
He's not going to read Fiona. He knows better than that.
Teleprompter Tim at all.
I'm Mon Burgundy. Fuck you, Seattle.
I'm not rapping for anyone.
Are you sure?
I could do some poetry.
Do some poetry.
Trust Brillig and the Slithy Toves did Gaia and Gimble in the Wabe. All mimsy were the Borogroves and the Moan Rats outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son. The jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird and shun the frumious Bandersnatch.
That's perfect. I just pressed record before that, so that will definitely go at the end of the podcast. I haven't had enough.